first came across the guest on this episode in the last few days of February 2020. You may recall that time vividly. I know I do. It was a time when a frightening new illness was sweeping the world, when the thoughts of an entire city being placed under strict lockdown, as Wuhan in China was at that time, was alien to most of us, and when coronavirus cases were skyrocketing in Europe and the United States and everywhere else. During those few days, one of the things that took my mind away from the virus, for a while at least, was a stunning piece of writing titled The Legacy of Mamba Sita, about Gianna Gigi Bryant, the daughter of basketball superstar Kobe Bryant, who died with her father in that helicopter tragedy back in January. I'm delighted to welcome the author of that piece, Mirren Fader, to episode 5 of this series, The Sports Writer's Life. My name is Shane Breslin, and this 12-part podcast is brought to you by Magnificent Irrelevance, which is aiming to become a new publishing venture bringing readers one standalone and standout piece of soul-searching sports writing every week. You can find out more about Magnificent Irrelevance and sign up for regular updates in the journey towards making it a reality by visiting magnificentirrelevance.com. Mirren Fader is a staff writer for The Ringer. She has written for the Orange County Register, ESPNW.com, SI.com, Slam, and Bleacher Report. Her work has been honored by the Associated Press Sports Editors, the U.S. Basketball Writers Association, the Football Writers Association of America, and the Best American Sports Writing Series. So let's get into it. This is episode 5 of The Sports Writer's Life with Mirren Fader. Mirren, good to see you.
It's good to see you too. Happy New Year.
And to you. And to you, yes. So the format of this show, it's a really short series. There's 12 parts. And the format is, you know, past, present, future of sports writing. If we look at the first of those first, what's your past? How did you get into this? What pathway did you follow?
Yeah, I was a basketball player. I didn't even think about writing or being a sports writer. And I played competitively pretty much my whole life. I loved it. But we all get to that point where it stops. And after I played my first year in college, I just realized it wasn't going in the direction that I wanted it to. And so I've secretly always loved writing. I've always loved English and literature and things like that. And so I thought, like, maybe I should become a sports writer. It would be a great way to, like, you know, combine these things and help me to stay in it. So it ended up being the best choice. You know, it was perfect. I could be like my nerdy self and my athletic self all in one.
So tell me a little bit about the basketball. Had you genuine aspirations of going far in basketball? Was that something you really wanted to do?
Yeah, when I was 10 years old, I grew up in Los Angeles. I made my parents take me to Storrs, Connecticut so that I could visit UConn because I was like obsessed with Diana Taurasi. And I was like, I need to go to UConn. I want to play in the WNBA. You know, I was like very serious about it. So I spent the next 10 years like training every day with the goal in mind of like Division I basketball and WNBA. And then I tore pretty much every ligament in my foot my junior year, heading into my junior year of high school. So that ruined pretty much everything. And also I'm really small, I'm 5 feet. So that was always an uphill battle. So I had all of these things against me and I ended up going to Lewis and Clark College, which is the only school that still recruited me after my injury. I had an awful time there. I hated it there. But at that point I was like, okay, should I try to play overseas? Like, could that be an option for me? And then I just, when I went to that school and I just hated it, I was like, no, I need to transfer to a place where I'm going to like, just enjoy college. And I need to figure out what else to do with my life.
So you were taking basketball so seriously from the age of 10. I heard you correctly. Right?
Yes.
And so at what age were you when you made that decision that this wasn't going to happen or you needed to do something else?
I was 19.
Okay. So that's half your life was taken up.
Yeah.
And the half your life where you were thinking about things more seriously. So what was it about basketball in particular that so attracted you?
I just love that it brought every emotion out of me. Like I was obsessed. Like it made me happy. It made me angry. It made me sad. I was just so like in love with basketball and like it was my best friend, you know, and it which making obviously leaving basketball later was almost like a divorce, like after a marriage of like a decade, you know. It was my best friend. I just think it was just something that was there for me always, you know. I could always do it, like it wasn't gonna go away. And I also, like, I think I just loved the challenge. I wasn't supposed to play basketball because I'm so small. And so the whole time, you know, it was, I used to tell people, like, the only thing small about me is my height. Like, I'm not a small person, you know, I know I'm tiny, but I'm not a small person. And I think I just love that people doubted me and like, didn't think I was supposed to be there. And that just like pissed me off. And I think that drove me more than anything was like, I want to prove everyone wrong. That almost was like more important to me than making it in a way.
The story you told and the way you spoke about basketball there reminded me of a story from the Elizabeth Gilbert book, Big Magic, where she talked about, there was a story about somebody in that book who had been taking ice, I think it was ice skating, like, you know, really, really seriously, competitively, had aspirations of, you know, being a professional ice skater. And at some point, it became apparent that that wasn't going to happen, and she stopped completely. And 30 years later, she was going through therapy, and she was in a bad place, a dark place. And her therapist asked her, you know, what memories do you have of joy, or what have you done that brought you joy? And she went right back instantly to her memories of ice skating, and she went back and ice skated in her mid-40s, having not skated on the ice at all for the 30 years after it became apparent that she wasn't going to do it competitively. Did you draw a line under it completely, or do you still kind of flex that muscle, that basketball muscle, in your spare time?
That's so funny, because I had the exact same experience minus the whole 30 years part. I completely like shut down with sports at first. Like, it, going to a basketball court made me feel so emotional that I couldn't like go without feeling like I was going to start crying, or like going to a game with friends. Like, I would get angry, like jealous, like I should be out there, or like, I just couldn't watch it on TV. It was like tearing me up inside. And I also was going through this like enormous crisis of like identity, because my sole purpose in life was doing this thing every day. And then what do you do when like there's nothing to build to anymore? Like, I'm not going to the WNBA. Like, what do I do with my time? And what do I wear? My whole, like, I wore basketball shorts and a hoodie every day from like kindergarten to like college. Like, I was just completely like, and then I felt embarrassed about it after, and I had to like change my whole wardrobe because I was like ashamed of like not being this person anymore. And so I actually went to therapy as well, and it was a process of like getting back on the court. It took like 5 years for me to like be able to be on the court and be okay with the fact that I didn't make it, and be okay with like who I am and not feel like emotional or ashamed about it, and also just like do it for fun. Like, I think I robbed myself of that joy, because it's so cutthroat, you know, when you're trying to make it, especially as like a tiny person. So I think I was able to come back to basketball with more joy than I did during my career. And she said, my therapist said the same thing, like, okay, shooting free throws alone gives you joy, like you should do that. And so it was a process in doing that. And so these days I still do that, although with Corona and like life, I can't. So it feels like it's been forever now, but yes, like prior to Corona, I was still like having that be a part of my life, you know?
In those 5 years that you weren't playing basketball, then you were clearly looking at doing other things. And did you transition quickly into writing? What was the story around that transition?
Yeah, so it basically replaced basketball. And at first I looked at it like plan B replacement, but then I fell in love with it on its own, and it stopped being like second option. We're doing this because we didn't make this. It was like, this is so much better than basketball. This is making me so much happier than I thought I could be. And by telling other people's stories, I could forget about my own. So it was this wonderful escape of like, yeah, this thing in me that I lived and did and gave me an empathy and understanding for other humans that actually helps me in my new job without making it about me. Like, I'm very empathetic, and empathy is such a key to reporting. And I think those experiences made me the reporter that I am, but I don't have to like, you know, talk about it or focus on it. It's about them, not me. And I just love that it's not about me. You know, I get to like be in the background, but like still be in a gym. I think just being in a gym is just, it's just very comforting to know that I have healed. You know, I can do that now. It doesn't bother me. In fact, I never think about it anymore. I'm so happy that I didn't make it in basketball now, you know, because this is awesome. I love this.
What was your first written piece that maybe got it into print or got it online and alerted you to the fact, or maybe convinced you to the fact that you have something here and you can make a real go of this?
I don't know if it was like, oh, I have something here, but it was like, oh, I love this. Like when I first started at the Orange County Register, and I was there for my first 4 years, and I was writing about people that nobody had ever heard of, you know, like junior colleges or youth or whatever. And I love that. But I think when I started freelancing for Bleacher Report in my third year at the Register, so that would have been like 16, 17, around there. Maybe a little bit. Yeah. 16, 17. I was like, okay, well, it's good enough for Bleacher Report. Right. So that means like, okay, maybe I can do this, you know, but I think it was just a process, you know. I think traveling overseas was definitely like gave me much more confidence. And so around that time, the following year, 2018, is when I started tackling like bigger stories. And I think that was like, okay, like I'm doing this, you know.
You, I think it's fair to say you have made a name for yourself for sure. And at some level, you've obviously decided to specialize in the bigger piece, the something that has a lot of nuance and layers to it, stories that have a lot of depth. How did that manifest? Because I know a lot of people, when they're getting into the industry, maybe feel that they need to do multiple years of maybe, you know, punching the clock before they can kind of aspire to the bigger, longer, more nuanced, more in-depth pieces. Did that come about quickly for you?
I mean, some people think it came about quickly. For me, I did 4 years at a regional newspaper. So for me, I'm like, no, it did not come about quickly. It was 4 years of trauma. But, you know, comparatively speaking, I guess it did come quickly. But it just never felt quickly for me. I went from like writing about 12-year-olds to like LaMelo Ball in Lithuania over a period of time. But I think like I was just not interested in like more analytical like beat stuff. Like I think when I was in my basketball years, that was very much me. I could tell you random stats. I knew this like 12-year journeyman's whole life if he popped up on the screen. Like I was very much like one of the guys like, I know random basketball trivia. But then I got older and I, you know, not making it in basketball, I just like, I didn't care anymore. Like it really didn't matter to me who was injured and who scored what. And like, I kind of just found it like very boring. I don't know. I just changed as a person and I just found the whole thing super boring. And so like whenever I would have to get assigned to like cover a game, I would just be like, oh my God, is this over yet? Like, I think it's not that I don't enjoy games. Obviously I do, but I just was like, this is so boring to me. Like if another athlete tells me we just need to play our game and step it up, like I'm going to flip a shit. Like, I think like, I just couldn't do it. And so I wanted to tackle the bigger stories because like, that is what I found interesting. Like I'm so much more interested in like what's going on in somebody's head and heart and one-on-one against himself than him against another player, you know, like I just, that's what makes me go, and finding out what makes other people go is fascinating to me. So I didn't like create that. I was just trying to follow my idols, like Wright Thompson, Gary Smith, like Jeff Perlman. Like these are people that like, you know, Sports Illustrated of the 90s. Like, I guess I was just born later, but I've always wanted to be them.
And did anybody open a door for you in terms of those bigger and more in-depth pieces, or was it something that you just had utmost confidence in the stories and your ability to tell them, and they just got seen? Or was there a gatekeeper anyway along the line that kind of gave you an opening?
Yeah, none of this would happen without the people that opened the gates. Okay, so when I was at the Register, Matt Sullivan, then a Bleacher Report, like, found me. And I remember I was sitting in the Starbucks on Melrose, and I was transcribing this stupid tennis story. And I was like, oh, it's so stupid. I don't even like tennis. And he's like, I don't know what he said. I'll have to go find the email for you. But I think he said, like, I think you have a lot of potential. And we're starting up BR Mag. And I want to talk to you. And I was like, oh, my God. And I, like, called everyone that I knew. And I was just thrilled. And I met him at a hotel. And that ended up, I had my tryout. They sent me to Philadelphia to profile Monet Davis. And so that was, like, the first gate open. And I did not get hired after that point. It would take a whole another year of writing for them until I get hired. But when Christina Tapper, who was my editor at that point there, she became the deputy managing editor and then the editor, she hired me. So there were these two people that just opened all the gates, and Ben Osborne as well, who was overseeing it all. So these three people just gave me a shot, you know? And it was like, I always said to myself, like, you got to be ready when you get your shot, because it might not come again. And I know that from basketball, from playing in front of, you know, scouts. You would go to these tournaments and it would be like so nerve wracking because you could see them sitting at the under the basket, and it would like be so terrifying. And so I guess just going through that made me think of it in similar terms, like, all right, whenever I get a shot, I'm going to give it my all, you know? And so yeah, thank God those people opened up the doors for me, because like I would not be here obviously without that opportunity.
So you mentioned that you've recently joined the Ringer from Bleacher Report. Tell us a little bit about what your day to day is like. What type of organization is the Ringer, and what's your day to day like within that right now?
Yeah, it's similar to Bleacher in that it's like a digital media property, but it's different because they have so many podcasts and they're owned by Spotify. It's really awesome place. I was very thankful to have, you know, gotten the chance to work there. My day-to-day is like pretty similar. You know, I focus on like about three or so long form stories at a time. And so if I'm reporting one, then I'm like writing the other and researching the third. So I'm doing that, and we'll be working on some podcasting stuff too. So I do all those things, and then I'm writing my first book. So I'm working on that as well. So I think, you know, pandemic, for better or for worse, has just forced me to sit here and do my work. I don't really do anything else. I mean, I work, I go on my new bike, I cook, and I work, and I sleep. You know, I think that's about it during Rona.
Yeah. And do you, like, I'm assuming before, say, March 2020, when coronavirus stopped the world, that your day to day, there was probably an awful lot of travel involved that won't have happened over the last 10 or 11 months. Are there any other big changes, or what's your experience been like of the pandemic?
Yeah, it went from like, I'm always on a plane to like, oh my God, I've never been in one place for this long. So in one sense, like I really needed this. Like I was extremely, I wouldn't say like burnt out, but I was extremely exhausted. I was on a plane like every other week probably. And it was really fun and awesome and amazing. And I was so lucky, but I was also like, like just so exhausted. And I would often take red eyes so that I could maximize, you know, I wouldn't feel like I was away for so long because I was really homesick and just missing, you know, my friends and life and stuff. So I would just be like red eye to red eye to red eye. And it was a real grind. But then, you know, I have never been in my apartment for this long. I know nobody has, but really I went from like nomad to like completely sedentary. And I've learned to like be peaceful with that and like have a new routine. It's honestly, obviously it's a terrible time, but it's been really nice for me to like reset my body, my whole being needed like a reset, you know. But it's completely different. All my interviews are over the phone. I've made it work, you know. I feel like I wrote stories this year I'm proud of, but obviously it's not the same as like sitting and, you know, one-on-one and getting coffee and like learning how somebody interacts in person, which is like a huge part of feature writing. So
you had two stories, I believe, featured in the Best American Sports Writing book, which I think is the last in the series of that book, unless something changes. I believe it's the last and will be sorely missed. So tell us a little bit about how that came about. And I'm sure it was an ambition for maybe a long time to have stories featured in a book like that.
Yeah, it was so cool. Somebody texted me a screenshot. They're like, "You made it." And I was like, "What?" it was really cool. I think I have every Best American Sports Writing for the last decade. I have like a section on one of my bookshelves. And so that was so, so cool, especially because it was edited by Jackie Mack. But yeah, it's just, I think every time I read it, it just reminds me like there's so many people doing this, you know. It can seem like sports media is very small because I think there's two different sports medias. There's your Twitter sports media, and then there's just like sports media at large. And it can make you feel like this very tiny bubble where you only think of certain people. But it's actually, I love this book because it just reminds me like there's so many people doing this. There's so many people that are so creative. It's kind of, this might be a really weird analogy, but I love jewelry and I love like crafts fairs. And so when I go to crafts fairs and there's like 50 million tents and there's all these people making different creative things, I always think to myself when I go, damn, there's so many creative people in this world. How are these many people making these many cool things? There's so many creatives out there. And that's what I feel when I open Best American Sports Writing or any of the, my friend got me Best American Food Writing this year because I love to bake and cook. And I'm just like, oh my God, there's so many smart people out there. Do you ever, I just think that all the time. There's so many creatives doing cool stuff, so.
I think we are made to create. I think that's part of whether it is cooking or furniture or writing or music. I think we are at one and in alignment when we are creating, I think. And I think a lot of the unhappiness that comes in the world is when we're detached or removed from that, because yeah, it's something that's really, really core, at the core of our being. Personally speaking, I think that's what I feel or I believe. So you've seen the world of sports media and sports writing from inside these two well-known, you know, big successful digital organizations. What do you see the direction or the future or trends that you've witnessed or you see coming down the tracks? Where do you see this going?
I don't know. I think whenever I'm asked that, it's just so hard because it's hard not to be like, well, the whole thing is crumbling, because it can feel that way. Of course, it's not. It's just a lot has. There's been a lot of damage and awful things. So I don't know where it's going. I think that the people in charge don't know where it's going either. I don't know. I always think about that. Like everyone thinks they know, and it's kind of like, we're kind of all just like dots in the sand. Like none of us know. And I know it's not a good answer, but I really think people don't know. But I do think that the organizations that seem to do well have a little bit of everything. Ringer, not just podcasts, has writing, has, you know, kind of shows and this and that. They do a lot of things. New York Times, writing, audio, document. They do a little bit of everything. I think the places that are like very, we're doing this and nothing else, like they don't do great. So I think it's got to be some mix of everything. It's not one over the other or none of this or, I think it's got to have like a mix of mediums.
Do you pay attention to, or are you brought into discussions about or briefings about the commercials on the commercial side of the business? I know that traditionally in old media, let's call it, or traditional legacy media, there was kind of those two sides of the house of the editorial and advertising, and there was the dividing line between the two, where they completely operated on their own in most cases. I know that from my experience that line has certainly blurred in some organizations, that there's a lot more, advertorial or branded content or sponsored content. Is the commercials and the business model, is that something that you pay a lot of attention to, or are you have you the freedom to really focus on the stories that you're working on?
I mean, I think I was really lucky in that I was like shielded from a lot of that. Like I knew what was going on, especially at Bleacher Report, but it like nobody ever, it was just like I had the space and time to just do me, but then, I had no idea that the layoffs were coming there and that everything was happening. Like we had no idea like what was happening business-wise. So, you're not really part of those things. My whole career, it's like I operate with the understanding I can wake up tomorrow and my job can be gone. So I think it's just like a sober reminder of like you just kind of never know. Like you could be doing your best work and get cut the next day. So
Yeah.
on the one hand, like I'm cognizant of it all, but I don't like I can't live like that. I can't live like always waiting for the shoe to drop. That's something I've learned this year. It's like why? If it drops, it drops and it's horrible and you deal with it and you find another place, hopefully, but you can't spend your whole time worrying
Yeah.
because then you won't get anything done and it's just debilitating.
Yeah, no, I understand. And I get, like, in we need organizations, don't we? Like, because I think there has been a trend towards, say, the Substacks and single person brands, one person media brands. And it's amazing that certain people or some people can do that. And congratulations and fair play to them. I don't personally, I'm not sure how viable that is for an industry in general. And I think we need that collaboration, and we need, like, we're better together, aren't we, in terms of how we bring stories to the world.
I mean, yeah, I'm of a similar opinion. I mean, I can't imagine publishing something without an editor looking at it. Like that just gives me like enormous anxiety. So I don't think that model would work for me. But I met one of the founders at this party, pre-Rona, and this was before Substack really took off. And he was like telling me about it, and I was like, that seems like interesting. But I didn't know it would become like what it is. I just You're at a party and you're trying to make small talk and I had no idea. But now it's just like interesting to see it come off. And that's why, there will be more of that in 2, 3 years, 5 years. There will be multiple versions of Substack. But yeah, thank God that I'm employed and have an editor. That's all I gotta say.
Yeah, no, editors, like, it's magic what editors can do. And I think that speaking to Glenn Stout in an earlier episode for this, we spoke about the editorial challenges, I guess, and the trends away from the editor, and I don't think that's a good thing. I think we need editors, and we need that collaboration with editors and writers to make things as good as they can possibly be. Miran, it's been a pleasure talking to you. My final question is an invitation, I guess. You have so many of these pieces that you've put together at length, telling these great stories over the last couple of years. If you were to put one or two of your own forward that you're especially proud of, that people can go and check out, and also if there was one or two from other people that you look up to, role model pieces, some of the best of the best. If you could put one or two of each of those forward, I'd love if you did.
Yeah, I guess for the people I admire, definitely got to be Wright Thompson's original story on Michael Jordan. So I think it's called like Michael Jordan has not left the building, or he's left the building. I don't know what
Yeah, yes.
something about the building. It was on his 50th birthday. That was like a couple years ago. That's my favorite piece of sports writing like ever. So I think that would be the first one. I'm trying to think what the next piece would be, because there's just so many. I read a story yesterday in the Washington Post by Kent Babb, who I really like. He's a great sports writer, and he wrote on Sean Kemp. So I'd recommend that. It came out yesterday, but because my mind is blanking
Yeah,
on the
no worries.
pantheon of sports writing, but that was a great piece. I really love Kent. I think the lead is so spectacular, because it was like this very simple, you know, Sean Kemp is smoking a joint, but you kind of felt like you were there with him inhaling. And it was a very simple way that he did that, but I was very drawn in. So I think that's a great example. I hope people read that. It was really good. Okay, and then personally, I would say my LaMelo Ball Australia story from last year, 2019, because LaMelo is seen as this arrogant, annoying, loud, spoiled heir to the throne, but he's actually nothing like what people think. And I think that story showed a much more vulnerable side, where he opened up to me about being exploited and what that's like. And so I think that's an important story. And then probably the other one was the one from this year on Gigi Bryant. It was like a feature obit. I just was really bothered by the way that she was like a footnote in Kobe's story, like, yeah, Annie had a daughter that loved UConn WNBA, and it was like end of story. There's nothing more. So I wanted to find out more about like who she was, and it was the hardest story to report and write, because I was talking to people in real time grief. You know, she had just died. Usually a lot of sports stories that revisit trauma are like wait a year later, but you know, because of time and all of those things, I had to do it like immediately. So I guess I'd recommend those too.
And it's a really good place to finish, because that story about Gigi Bryant was the story that led me to you. It was the first story of yours that I read, so that's a nice place to finish.
Yay! Thank you for
Yeah.
reading. Thank you for
Miren,
reading it.
it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, this was so fun. Thank you.
Shane here again, really briefly. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Sports Writer's Life. If you enjoyed the show, please do one or all, if you like, of these three things. First of all, a review would be amazing. Find the show on Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or whatever system you use. If there is a review functionality, go ahead and post a review. That helps to get this show to more listeners around the world. If you don't know where to go, I will post a link to the Apple Podcast review system in the show notes of this episode. Secondly, please do subscribe to The Sports Writer's Life to make sure that all 12 of these episodes appear in your podcast player as they go live in the coming weeks. And thirdly, head on over to magnificentirrelevance.com to hear more about the plans for this new publication, which aims to bring readers one standalone and standout piece of soul-searching sports writing each week. Thanks again for being here. This is Shane Breslin signing off, and I'll be back to you soon with the next episode of The Sports Writer's Life.